The NFL playoffs are better with FanDuel because right now new customers can bet $5 and get $200 in bonus bets, guaranteed. That's $200 in bonus bets, win or lose. FanDuel, an official sportsbook partner of the NFL. 21 plus and present in select states. First online real money wager only. $5 first deposit required. Bonus issued as non-withdrawable bonus bets which expire 7 days after receipt. Restrictions apply. See terms at sportsbook.fanduel.com. Gambling problem? Call 1-800-GAMBLER.
At Kroger Pharmacy, care is what's most convenient for you. Care is being here when you need us. We're open evenings and weekends. Care is helping you save more. Most insurance plans and discount cards are accepted at your local Kroger Pharmacy. Care is saving you time by managing your prescriptions online. You can request refills, check order status, and more. Care is convenience that works for everyone. Kroger Health, a world of care is in store. Services and availability vary by location. Age and other restrictions may apply. For coverage, consult your health insurance company. Visit the pharmacy or our site for details.
Welcome to the Edge of Sports podcast, brought to you by The Nation Magazine. I'm Dave Zirin. We've got a very special show this week. I'm very excited for you to hear it and for you to tell other people about it because I really do think it's a canary in the coal mine of things to come. First and foremost, the show is me interviewing Derek Silva, who co-authored a book called The End of College Football. And we did this interview together in front of a crowd at the Great Politics and Prose Bookstore in Washington, D.C. And I definitely want to thank them for this audio, which allows me to bring this crucial discussion to you. But there's another aspect of this meeting that you're going to quickly find out. And that is that Derek Silva's co-author of The End of College Football, Nathan Kalman Lamb, is somebody who was denied entry into the United States during inauguration weekend. And that in and of itself, I think, says a great deal. So please listen to the interview, Derek Silva, End of College Football. You're going to learn a ton about the way we understand this incredibly popular American fascination.
Tonight, we are welcoming Derek Silva to Politics and Prose, where he will be discussing his new book, The End of College Football, co-authored with Nathan Kalman Lamb. Nathan was scheduled to join us tonight as well, but he was detained at the U.S. border and has not been permitted to enter the country. Nathan has asked us to express on his behalf that he was very much looking forward to this conversation and that he is grateful to Dave and to the audience here at Politics and Prose. The End of College Football investigates the exploitation of college football players by university sports programs. Based on firsthand accounts from college football players, this book weaves a fascinating story which puts the football players at the center, celebrating them for their passion while condemning a system which exploits this passion for economic gains, gains which the players are not allowed to benefit from themselves. Derek Silva will be in conversation today with Dave Zirin, sports editor for The Nation, as well as the author of 11 books. Please join me in welcoming Derek Silva and Dave Zirin to Politics and Prose.
For Derek, everybody. Whoa! That didn't go as I thought it would. All right, man. Hey, thanks everybody for coming out. I'm Dave Zirin. This is Politics and Prose.
Do you need this for the recording?
Ah, okay. It's all good. I really appreciate folks coming out on what is a very intense weekend here in Washington, D.C. I think a byproduct of that intensity, for lack of a better word, is why only Derek is here and not Nathan, frankly. And so before we begin, before I talk to Derek about this amazing book, The End of College Football, the provocative arguments that it raises, and then throw it to the crowd to see if you have any questions for Derek, I do want to ask you, please, if you could give us an update on Nathan, how he's doing. I know he woke up at 2:30 a.m. to come here from Canada. You know, the 51st state? No. Go ahead, please.
Yeah, absolutely. So, I got a text message at about 12 a.m. or yeah, 12 p.m., I guess, noon. And Nathan was in the Montreal airport, and he was pulled out or pulled aside before he got to the line to talk to a customs officer. And so they knew he was coming. They knew his face. They knew his name, asked for his passport and said he would not be permitted into the country. Not related as far as he can tell. They wouldn't tell him why. And not related to work visa issues or anything like that. The best guess is that Nathan has been an outspoken pro-Palestinian liberation person on social media and a bunch of in that vein. And his best guess is that that has something to do with it. And this may or may not be a sort of new normal that we have to kind of experience with what we say on social media and to kind of Canadians trying to come to the United States.
Now, that's one theory.
Yes.
But maybe the boosters at Ohio State and Notre Dame are just so powerful.
Yeah, that's right. That's,
they didn't want you here tonight.
I said that to Nathan. I'm like, that is probably a better guess, to be honest.
So I got to ask you. We're about to see this national championship game, Ohio State, Notre Dame, two of the most high-profile programs in all the land, expecting record ratings, incredible interest, and you want all of this to end, or think it should.
Yes.
Why should college football end?
Well, that's a huge question and a layered question. I would say at the end of the day, football itself needs to be rethought. College football, specifically, needs to be completely abolished because of not only the things that make football kind of morally unsustainable, and I get to that in just a moment, but because it's the most egregious site of wage theft that we have and that we see in contemporary United States culture. Football, we know that every 2.6 years of participation in football and tackle football doubles one's chance of contracting CTE. We know that football players have a 61% increased chance of developing Parkinson's disease. At the college and the professional level, that goes up to 300%. So when you think of the damage that's done to one's brain playing tackle football, that is not worth all of the pageantry and all of the beauty, all of the things that people like about the sport. So the sport itself, we actually would argue, and we do in the book, should be abolished, college football specifically, because this is a massive system that we've erected of racialized wage theft that targets particular populations and steals from those people massive amounts of revenue, we're talking billions of dollars, and funnels it to primarily white, overwhelmingly white, almost exclusively white overseers in terms of coaches, athletic directors, athletic department staff, ESPN, the whole media, college sport media, industrial complex, advertisers, et cetera, et cetera. So it runs counter to everything that a sort of just society would be.
You write about it in the context of being a neo-plantation economy. And you use a phrase that I've heard a lot more in recent years, racial capitalism.
Yeah.
Can you explain what racial capitalism is and how it applies to college football?
Yeah, racial capitalism is a concept developed by Cedric Robinson in his book, Black Marxism, that talks about the systemic extraction and systematic extraction of wealth from racialized populations. That is done, that can be done in a variety of different forms, that can be done in overt ways through things like slavery. It can also be done more insidiously and indirectly through systems like the NCAA, where revenue is generated on the backs of disproportionately racialized people, and it's funneled to disproportionately white people. In this case, it's a racialized group of athletic workers who are so-called student athletes, although we prefer the concept campus athletic worker, and we use that in our book, and it is funneled to white overseers, coaches. To use an example, Jimbo Fisher was paid almost $80 million to not coach. He was fired and to not do his job. And he was paid $80 million to do that and is still being paid to do that, to not do his job. Whereas the campus athletic workers earning the revenue that paid that are not allowed to see even a single dime of it. And the counter argument would be, well, they get a scholarship. We can get there and we can kind of, or I would love a question in the Q&A about whether or not we should consider a scholarship a form of compensation.
See, I hear your analysis about how it's structured in a racist manner and the issue of extraction. I want to get back to that too. That's so important about how much money is actually produced in college football and where that money goes, because that's also shifting a little bit right now. And we need to talk about the shifting sands under our feet. But first, to call football or college football in particular, like to call it racist, it raises though questions about, if it is racist, how do we explain its deep popularity in communities of color? How do we explain high school football scenes in states around the United States? How do we explain that in a lot of high schools, the least segregated place in the high school is the football team? I mean, at least that's been our experience. And also, like, when you give your answer, I'm really curious what you just say about that, because I don't think we can reduce it to just saying its popularity is due to people wanting scholarships or a dream shot at the NFL. It seems to run much deeper in the marrow than that.
Yeah, I think so. So there's, again, multiple layers to this question. And I agree. I don't think it's as simple, and we can't reduce the answer to this question to be, oh, well, they're just seeking a sort of payday at the end of the day. There is a true reality, and we spoke with campus athletic workers about this, that they enjoy the act of playing. They enjoy playing on Saturdays. There's something about the visceral connection to the sport and the connection that means to that person's community, that person's family, that person's friends, et cetera, that is real. On top, or layered on top of that, is and must be a centering of the discussion of what they have to give up in order to please that kind of effective emotive connection, and whether or not what they are sacrificing is actually worth that emotive connection. Does it have to be football? Is a constant question I always ask. Does it have to be that these athletes sacrifice their brains to get that connection and to feel that positive energy, or can it be something else? There are many sports to play.
But it is such a condemnation, though, to me, even less of football than of how atomized we are as a society and how alienating it is to be a teenager in this world right now, that when you see something that does provide community, that maybe even provides in your head an answer to racism and to division, because, hey, here I am and I actually have friends and community. I mean, there's a lot that goes with that in terms of masculinity as well when it comes to football. But I think that part of it always needs to be in the conversation, because when you ask, what do we replace it with? That's a big discussion. So let's talk about name, image, and likeness, NIL. This is really important. Players are making money now, sometimes millions with the transfer portal. They can go from school to school. They have more freedom of movement than athletes in the pro sports. I mean, is this what economic justice looks like?
No. Nathan and I have written about this in many different pieces, including The Nation, and talked about how NIL is this fig leaf, if you will. NIL does little, I would argue almost nothing, to alleviate the economic injustice that we're seeing. What this actually has led to is the fact that now third parties can pay the workers for additional labor. So in this way, it's a new form of gig work. We've called it in several places, that these athletes are not being paid for their work, for the sacrifice of their brains, the sacrifice of their bodies every day for 4, 5, 6 years, and then on Saturdays playing games. They're not being paid for that. They're being paid to hawk chicken for the local chicken shop. They're being paid to sign autographs at somewhere. They're being paid to post on Instagram a link to a discount code. That's what they're being paid. That's additional labor. So when we're talking about the remunerative exchange to campus, it's not payment for play. It's not paying them for doing their labor. It's additional labor. So it's a new form of gig work. And on top of that, the NIL has given this kind of legitimacy to the argument that you've kind of articulated there, that, oh, they're being paid now, so everything's good. Everything's fine. And it's sidestep, or it's been used as a distraction to prevent any form of pay for play to actually happen. And every NCAA president since Walter Byers has adamantly, we will never have pay for play. We will never have, even to this day, there's still no pay for play.
And that's with Walter Byers, who also at the end of his long tenure as head of the NCAA, didn't he describe it as a plantation economy? Yeah,
and a nationwide money laundering scheme, he said in his deposition. This is the person who created the concept that we all, the moniker we all use of student athlete. He created this in 1964 in order to sidestep claims for football players who are attempting to get work person's compensation. It was literally created and drafted into NCAA lore and policy in order to sidestep the question of employment status and rights that we all should have as laborers in a highly violent a sport that is defined by violence and harm and abuse and physical and corporeal harm.
Now, you interviewed several dozen college football players for the book. What did you learn that surprised you? That, you know, and did you have any preconceptions that got strongly challenged in the process of doing these interviews?
Yes. So there were so many stories, and I don't want to get into them. I would prefer folks buy the book because the stories are in the book. If anything, this book is about amplifying campus athletic workers' voices and not about our own voices as author. In terms of what surprised me, the level, the disregard for bodies and minds that occurs every single day across this nation in locker rooms. I'll share one story. And this was a senior campus athletic worker, a captain on the football team, decided to be a leader, as they are often urged to be, and asked the junior and the freshman folks to come in to like on a Friday night or Saturday night and watch the film Concussion. So word got around the locker room that this person was doing that and inviting, and his coach pulled him aside and said, you will have no career if you do that. You will absolutely not show these younger football players that movie. And if you do, you will have no career. And to me, like, things like that just showed, like, I knew coaches in my own experiences at South Carolina. I experienced some of this myself. Like, I knew coaches, some coaches were really bad on this, but I didn't know the level. I didn't know the level of disregard.
How did this happen? I mean, why are we the only country in the world where our institutions of higher learning are the minor league system for our most popular sports league? I mean, when you say it out loud, it does seem odd.
Yeah.
Like, How did this happen? And why is it not this way everywhere, just about everywhere else on earth?
I think it is that the United States is so fundamentally saturated in racial capitalism that it is other places, certainly, it's not to suggest that there's no capitalism elsewhere, but it's just capitalism has a grasp on the entire ideology that exists in both in sport, politics, everywhere in society, and that saturation leads to this type of system, leads to a system that's about capital accumulation as much as possible. And in this case, the sort of ephemeral place of campus athletic workers, they're only quote unquote employed, if we want to use that term, for 4 or 5 years. They're in and out. There's so much power of college athletes. It's very hard for those athletes to mobilize together and act in solidarity. And we see the same thing in the NFL as well. The NFL is probably the weakest, the NFLPA is probably the weakest professional union in all of professional sports. Similar, there's the average NFL career is like 3.5 years. So it's similar in terms of timing. So all of those reasons, the fact that there's so much union bust, historically there's been so much union busting, and again, we wrote about this in The Guardian during COVID years about union busting of NCAA. And in football, I just think it's so tangible. It's so obvious. And yeah, again, capitalism is the...
And it does seem like everything you're talking about, particularly you're speaking about what we know of as student athletes as campus athletic workers, mm-hmm. that unionization holds an answer for a lot of what you're talking about, whether it's negotiating about health, whether it's to be able to have a grievance if someone says, hey, you're not allowed to show that movie,
yep.
you know, some sort yep. of third party grievance. There are people right now who work on this, who are yep. trying to organize yep. college football players. Are they on a fool's errand? And I ask you that with respect yeah. to yeah. their work. But is that a fool's errand to think that the conditions in a college football world could ever be ripe for widespread industrial unionization?
I don't think so at all. And I've seen, even in the years that I've been working in this area, I've seen so much progress, to the point where we had Jennifer Abruzzo, the head or the head legal of the NLRB, actually release a memo, an official memo, that said these campus athletic workers should be viewed as employees and have the rights accorded to everyone that is an employee in terms of unionization. So when that memo, and we had Jennifer on our podcast, The End of Sport, talking about this, when that memo dropped, this was in 2021. And that sent shockwaves through. We've seen the recent House settlement. We've seen attempts to unionize, more micro attempts at Dartmouth and a variety of other places. So I think we, in some ways, are on the precipice of unionization, and I think it can happen. I absolutely do not think it's a fool's errand, and there's some great work being done. Jason Stahl, there's a bunch of people doing work. And I think in the next 5 years, we'll see a pretty strong movement to unionization, even with a Trump administration.
Yeah, that would be good. I think when we talk about NIL and power, this is just my read on it, and I want to know your thoughts, mm-hmm. that we now have this very distorted locker room yeah. at the big yes. time college. Yeah. And how sustainable is a system where the quarterback is handed, you know, $6 million to transfer from Texas to Michigan, and, you know, their quote unquote job is not really much of anything, you know, start a podcast.
Yeah.
And yet the offensive linemen are only really being paid in nothing.
Yeah.
Like, how is that even sustainable for a team
yeah.
with that kind of bifurcated structure? And it just seems like this entire system has no guardrails, no rules. Coaches, like famous old coaches, are quitting left and right.
Yeah. Yeah.
So the fact that people like Nick Saban are quitting and Dabo Swinney are complaining. Yeah.
Well, he complains about everything.
Yeah, he does. That's true. But it just leads me to think that there is a shifting power dynamic yeah. happening, yeah. but at the same time, it's also very distorted and unfair. But it is happening. Yeah. Like your book is effectively, it's brilliant because of the way it centers the players' voices, but you are writing about a moving target.
Yeah. Yeah. And I agree. It's not sustainable. And it is, like, many people have classified this as like the wild, wild west. There's no regulation, and there's such little regulation that even former athletes and current professional athletes are kind of taking advantage of the lack of regulation to try to create these kind of collectives when it comes to NIL and exploit further and earn dollars out of, like, pooling together athletes into a collective NIL. And, you know, there's like a manager take sort of off the top. And you're completely right. There's so much inequality in terms of how this is being distributed. You do have people earning millions of dollars, and then you'll have ESPN, CBS, ABC running those, like talking and writing stories about how, oh, college football players are making millions. Those are very, very few people are making millions of dollars on nil, and more people, and most, the overwhelming majority, are earning $30 or a sponsorship with Liquid IV, and they get a like month-long Liquid IV subscription for like posting a discount code on their Instagram with 5,000 followers. And which athletes are getting the good deals? Often the athletes who are very marketable in very marketable positions, not the athletes that every single down of every single play and every single down and every single play in practice are smashing their heads against someone else's. Those are the folks that aren't getting the linemen, that aren't getting the million-dollar deals, and those are the people who are objectively, empirically at a heightened risk of things like CTE.
So is the answer in the short term abolition or unionization? Like if someone comes to you and they say, I go to Ohio State, your book really affected me. What should I be looking at? What should I be arguing for? Yeah.
So abolition is the ultimate argument of the book. And ultimately that's what we view, both Nathan and I view football itself as morally indefensible and unsustainable, college football as the most egregious site of wage theft, as being the most morally unsustainable. But that is not going to happen. The college football is not going to go away tomorrow. We understand that. There's a bunch of things that can happen today that can materially uplift the people in that position and offer protections. One certainly being unionization. Unionization is not just about collectively bargaining. It's not just about revenue sharing. I would argue, more importantly, it's about creating safe working environments, that there are laws associated, or there can be collectively bargained working conditions or changes to working conditions that make it more safe. If you will, that means not practicing and just playing. If that means not practicing with helmets so people don't hit, there's a variety of things that can happen. Unionization would provide that. It's not just about unionization, though. There's also the very real reality that these athletes are injuring their bodies, their minds while they're playing football. And then they leave football. Even the ones who go pro leave football, and they're facing consequences that they experienced and they received health consequences while they were playing football. So we view like lifetime health insurance as something that must happen in college athletics. And there's money for that. There's absolutely money for that. Thirdly, if we're to rethink the system, the wedding of athletics with higher education, we have to fundamentally rethink that. And we have to rethink the fact that many people don't have opportunities to go to university and they're using football for that reason. So if we take that away, if we change that fundamental, if we make it financially unsustainable for the universities, those opportunities go away. So we have to fundamentally rethink higher education in terms of accessibility and who is able to get in, SAT scores, the cost of tuition. All of these things need to be rethought. This is just as much a question about higher education as it is about college football. So with that, free tuition, we would argue, again, that might not be a thing that is going to happen, but rethink tuition. There's no reason why a university needs to cost $40,000 a year. So lifelong health insurance, admissions and tuition. And then if we are to continue in this college football system that we currently have, we have to accept that campus athletic workers, football players in particular, cannot access the same educational experience as anyone else. How many people have to do a 40 to 60 hour, absolutely strenuous job on top of their university studies? And what about summer internships, travel abroad programs, all of these things that they don't have access to because of sport, because of their football. So a way to alleviate that is lifetime scholarships as well, which seems to be a no-brainer. You don't have to do your school while you're here. You have 4 years for your entire life. Come back 8 years later, come back 10 years, whatever. Come back in 5 years and you can access that education the same, and that's not currently offered.
Mm. Yeah, I have so many horror stories from players about classes they were told to take, classes they were told not to take, the professor who would hook them up, the professor they should never talk to, who usually are the best professors, the ones you should never talk to. But you said it's bigger than college football. It's about it's a question about higher education. I wonder if the question gets even bigger when we look at the way, I mean, let's think about what the biggest college football towns are in this country, or places like South Bend, Indiana, and Tuscaloosa, Alabama. And, you know, these are places that would economically be devastated if there was no college football. And it's so different. Like, it's a mirror about how our country's changed, because like South Bend, Indiana used to be like an industrial city where, you know, Notre Dame played football, and now it's a football town. And if the team does badly, then everybody does badly, which creates layers of, I don't want to use the complicity, but defense, you know, and psychological defense. I wonder what that does to pushing forward this argument when people don't just have a psychological stake, but a material stake in seeing college football live.
Yeah, a lot of these same arguments are made in defense of the prison industrial complex well.
That's right.
And I would argue in both cases is the damage that is being done to the people creating that revenue, is that worth it? Mm. Is that if 91% of brains that play college tackle football have CTE, which according to Boston University and Ann McKee is an empirical reality. If every 2.6 years, your chance of CTE doubles, and that's just one disease in the brain. We talked with campus athletic workers who have 600 pages of medical notes from their time. We talked with people who had 10 concussions. We talked with people who have tore their ACL and MCL like multiple times and had it reconnected, torn Achilles. These things affect people's lives. It affects their ability to pick up their child. It affects their ability to mow their lawn for the rest of the, is it worth it? Anytime I think about it, and in fact, when we probed that, when we like asked campus athletic workers, would you play football if you had access to a university education and everything that comes with that? Overwhelmingly, they said no. Mm. And many of them were like, I would have played basketball. I would have played baseball. I was a star athlete. These people are very athletic. They're like the top. They're very athletic. They can do other things. Mm. But it was football that afforded them the opportunity. So the short answer is I don't think the risks are worth creating an entire economy on a foundationally harmful sport.
Mm. One last question, and then we're going to open it up to all you fine folk for questions, comments, and the like. I'll give some instructions on that. But first, just one last question, because I don't know if folks know that Derek and Nathan have an amazing podcast called The End of Sport. Terrific pod. And anyone who listens to that pod knows that you guys have very, very eclectic interests when it comes to sports, politics, culture. Yeah. Why did you two narrow in on college football, given the wide variety of directions you could have gone in for a joint book?
It's a great question. And the preface of the book provides an answer to this question. So again, I urge people to buy the book. And I'm not going to go into that, into it too much. But when Nathan and I got together and started talking about not only the podcast, like creating the podcast, like COVID was happening. So we started the podcast in April of 2020. It was right at the beginning of COVID. And this is when this project really started. And I couldn't believe on the news, I was seeing like everyone was sent home, lockdowns everywhere in Canada, where I'm from. I'm Canadian. There were like full lockdowns here, a little bit less, but full lock. So the whole world is shut down. And then like I'm talking to some of the former athletes that I taught at South Carolina. We're still on campus. We're at practice every single day. And I was floored. I was absolutely floored that that is a reality. So if we don't care about their health in a global pandemic. We don't care about their head, their brains. We don't care about their knees or their backs. What do we care about? We only care about these people insofar as they're able to support our cities, to support our universities. And that's a fundamental problem. So seeing the COVID years, and there's an entire chapter on the COVID season in the book, because it's such a perfect example of everything that we talk about.
Wow.
Everybody, give it up for Derek Silva, please. It's really...
Thank you all for coming.
I'm really glad you're raising these issues. So if you put your hand up, I'll call on you. And I'd ask people to walk up to the microphone, please, so you can be recorded for posterity. I will go to you if you can't go to the microphone, so everybody gets a chance. And I see you, sir. And the gentleman in the back with the beard can walk up to the microphone. In the green, that's you. Yep. But before you speak, I just want to say I'm going to keep people at about 2 minutes. And so if I say wrap up after 2 minutes, please know that it is not a comment on anything that you are saying, just to make sure we get as many voices as possible. The person there in the brown can line up. Anybody wants to just line up? We could just start lining up. That's great. Even better. And folks could say their first name, so we all get to know each other a little bit.
Hello, my name is Kenneth. Nice to meet you. David, I read you in a Progressive, and I believe football is the sport on top right now. It'll change. But the People's History of Sport, a great book. And so this just seems like the culmination of all sport. Jim Thorpe was exploited, Jack Johnson, baseball players without helmets. Gordie Howe was a superstar, had to go out for a fight every night. And it was demanded for entertainment.
Yeah.
So it just seems more of like it's thing there. Yeah. So I just want to share that. A fun question, then my real question is, tell us, I have no idea, like when the Gamecocks became Gamecocks, but what do you call a female Gamecock? Like who goes to your campus? So
I think they just call them, I think it's just Gamecocks. It's such a weird, I would see many sexual innuendos when I was on campus there with like t-shirts, and mostly they were like the young, apparently female folks.
Amen. Well, my real question is, Title IX was a great invention.
Yeah.
And so all this money's out there. So I'm making numbers. Is it $20 million the actual Ohio football team's making? Is the girl volleyball player going to get it? The girl soccer ball player, the tennis player?
Yeah.
Me, the dart thrower in a bar? Like, so I'm worried about the girls once again to be pushed aside.
Yeah.
Okay. So that's it. Title IX in this world.
Yeah. It's a great question. One, I simply, when the question is like, what about other sports? I simply don't, again, it's a question about like risk. Is it worth putting certain people, racialized men, through this in order to keep other sports alive? Or is there another way that we can keep those other sports happening? Am I concerned in practice that it would, that getting rid of abolishing college football would also lead to like typical neoliberal cuts and austerity measures? And I'm certainly concerned about that. But at the end of the day, I don't think any justification to hold any other sport up on the brains, let's put it specifically, on the brains of predominantly black football players. I'm not swayed. I'm not compelled by that argument that that's worth it. But yes, I'm certainly I'm concerned, and it's a legit concern.
Hi, my name's Christian. A big fan of you and Nathan's work. I just want to ask about, you talked earlier about the convergence of athletic and academic interests, and I wanted to ask if it was a potentially viable strategy to actually diverge those interests. Mm-hmm. We're talking about like other countries like Japan and Canada, where they have like, for investment in amateur athletics, they have like federal like agencies or whatever the equivalent is. Like Pakistan is part of their defense budget.
Yeah.
But like the uniqueness of how we like make so much money and turn college sports into a $1 billion industry, we also have a uniqueness of not having any official really government investment in amateur athletics for like those purposes.
I think that is one absolute something I would advocate for. And the U.S. is exceptional in this case. Like there are many, many templates for how the divergence of higher education and athletics could actually work. And Canada is one example, although Canada, I'm trepidatious there because Canada is kind of trying to follow and trying to model the NCAA in terms of their youth sports system. And we're seeing like athletic programs now signing deals with Under Armour, Nike, et cetera, very similar to the United States. So I would advocate for the divergence of those and creating systems of funding sports systems and not making universities like the minor leagues and or the Olympic training grounds. Like we don't, the Canadian Olympics don't come from, Olympians don't come from university sport. Often they come from NCAA sport, to be honest. So I think that ultimately we have to disconnect those two, period. End of story. That is a solution, a long-term solution here. A great question. Thank you so much.
Hi, my name is Lauren. My question is for the both of you. Knowing what you know, do you watch football and college football specifically? And if and when you do, how do you navigate that morally when we consider any form of consumption, a degree of endorsement?
Yeah.
Do you want to Yeah, start? I'll go first. This is a big question for my family on a lot of fronts. First of all, I don't watch college football for the reasons, you know, and I think in life, you know, we all have our lines. You know, I do watch NFL football. My son plays high school football, and I got to tell you, if I, set up a fence between him and the football field and I stood in front of that fence and said, halt, I would be run over and the fence would be run over and he'd be playing football. And that's where a lot of my thoughts about this come from, is the way it gets in people's system can sometimes, it can feel a little scary sometimes. Like it's not just, I want that scholarship. It's, I want a family. I want all of this. And, you know, so that's, you know, we all have our morality lines on this stuff. There's so much about football that's objectionable to me. I am following the NFL playoffs. But a big reason for that, I have to say, I'm not going to pretend like I'm not actually enjoying doing it. But I have to say that part of it is because I'm a sports writer, and football is so, and I write about the intersection of sports and politics, and football is so hegemonic in this country. I mean, 43%, you know, the second most popular sport is like 11%. You know, it's unbelievable. So I have to follow it too. Otherwise, I'm not really writing about sports, because sports and football are almost synonymous when you have a sports, especially a sports politics conversation in the United States.
So I do not watch college football. I view it as morally unsustainable and indefensible in my view. Do what you like. I do watch and some professional football, but for reasons that are not associated whatsoever to the pleasurable aspect or the fandom aspect of the game. I watch it because many former students play in the NFL. Some people in this book play, and I support those people, and I want to see them do well. And to be honest, I'm actually, every time I'm turning on the TV and I see them on the field, I'm like nervous that there's going to be, like, I'm scared for them. So I'll turn on the odd game, but I don't watch it for any sort of pleasurable aspect of that. And there's a level of complicity in that. I would not say there's always a degree of complicity. And to some extent, we always have to grapple with that question just to be alive in capitalism. We're complicit in some of the world's worst harms by having an iPhone, for instance. Like, am I not going to have an iPhone? It's a challenging question. So we have to, again, fight the battles that we kind of can fight, I think. And some of them aren't as worth it.
And I'm going to be pretty happy if Lamar wins on Sunday. It'll be almost involuntary, but it'll be there.
Hi, thank you for your comments. I guess I have a similar sort of question, but maybe we can dig in a little bit more. I looked at part of your book, and I know you guys have written about this idea of spectacle in football and spectatorship. So I guess I have the same sort of feeling about what is it that makes it so alluring for people, and especially in this historical moment. In a society that's falling apart, that doesn't encourage us to take care of ourselves, that, you know, where you get laughed at if you wear a mask, all kinds of things. And I know you've written about social reproduction. If you could just explain that sort of concept and your ideas around this idea of spectacle. Mm-hmm. And then I guess I'll leave it at that because I'm sure you have a lot to say about that. But I'm also curious about approaching football as a public health issue in addition to a labor issue. So any, I don't know if they're somehow tied, but thank you.
Yeah, no. Thanks for your question. Yeah, I think the spectacle, so Nathan's written a bunch on social reproduction theory and applying it to the case of both hockey, professional ice hockey, and football. In terms of like spectacle and the role that sort of plays in society and in our like fandom, like even if we go back to Karl Marx's idea of like religion is the opiate of the masses, in some ways, like sport is, and I would argue that football is a peculiar case of that. In order to help folks or alleviate folks with the issues that they have, like dealing with everyday life and going and selling their labor to the capitalist system and receiving very little profit and becoming alienated from that product that you're producing, whether that be intellectual or material. One of the ways in which we can deal with that and we can become like pacified and do our own sort of capitalist work. When it comes to college football, and I think that this is where our current moment and the tensions amongst people are really, it's kind of scary and disheartening, is that football is like the worst form of that, where like people are watching and the people who are sacrificing themselves are of a particular socioeconomic background. And if we're as fans using that as an outlet for ourselves to deal with our own exploitation, again, we have to sit there and sit with that and be like, what does it mean that I'm watching a disproportionately racialized group of people sacrificing themselves so that I can like put my feet up, open my Bud Light and watch sports at the end of the day? Because all of that is reproducing this system. Football as spectacle is doing the job of continuing, and football is not the only professional sport in general, is doing the job of social reproduction so that we all go to work, so that we all continue to do this.
I mean, social media is that too, right? I mean, we're
100%.
And you talk about the, like, I have this ridiculous line where I'm still on Instagram, but I'm not on Twitter because Musk is the worst and Zuckerberg, yeah, I guess he's the worst now too. I guess I'm going to get off Instagram. Da, 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 da. But you take a step back from it and you realize we're giving our intellectual property for free to billionaires.
Yeah.
And that is like a hyper form of social, because we're also reproducing their direct profits, not just our own.
Yeah. The text itself.
Yeah.
Yeah, absolutely.
Wow. Sorry. My mind is blown, dude. Sorry.
I'm Marty. Thank you for coming. My question sort of builds on Christian's about separating athletics and academics. Americans are not in the habit of joining clubs. Mm-hmm. Universities are one of the few places we still do it. Student groups, alumni associations, credit unions. In Europe, sports are organized by clubs.
Yeah.
Do you think that there is a way that we can democratize college sports, take power out of the hands of university administrators and give it to the players and their communities?
I think this goes actually with Dave's question about like unionization. I actually think like unionization is one way to do that. It is one avenue through which that can actually happen, and that it can become a more democratized space. In terms of the model of clubs, like absolutely, that's a great model to, whether or not that would be the final outcome of something that begins at unionization, builds to revenue sharing, builds to all these other things that that might cause a fundamental collapse of the like NCAA system, if they're revenue sharing with other sports, like around 50-50, 40-60, whatever that revenue sharing, suddenly it might fundamentally reshape college athletics. And then what might emerge from the ashes of that, that could be a club system. I think that would be a natural way to do it. That would be the sort of obvious way to do it. Would that actually happen? I'm not sure. Like, you're talking different historical roots there and different histories of what it means to be collective, whereas something in the United States, the history of collectivity is very different than the history of collectivity in like the UK or Canada. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, before the next speaker, I'll just say Jack Scott's book, The Athletic Revolution. I mean, it didn't work for a lot of interesting reasons that we don't have to go into, but he tried to do exactly what you said at Oberlin in the early 70s in a way that had a real eye on things like gender, racial equity, and things that were frankly ahead of their time in terms of his conception. It's worth reading.
Yeah.
Hi, thank you. My name is Guthrie. I'm a huge listener to the pod.
Great, thank you.
And I was a sports management student in college, and it's pod has really kind of made me rethink my own education. So on that note, I know you're not a sport management professor, but kind of how could like students and universities like kind of like learn the truth about this and what they're, I mean, the school I went to didn't have football, but especially at some of these bigger schools where it's more of a way of life, like how could they make themselves aware of like how harmful this is?
I would say don't take sport management, but it's almost part and parcel of taking sport management. Sport management, for those folks who are unaware of like the academia and the silos, it's connected to business schools, and it's very much or often connected to business schools, and often very business oriented to produce the most revenue and to manage sport in the very traditional sense. Nathan and I both come at it from a sociological, philosophical, political economy kind of lens. So I would say like that's where the critique is strongest of. But that said, like I attend NAS, the North American Society for Sociology of Sport, and NASM, North American Society for Sport Management. And there is a good group of sport management, critical sport management people doing this work. So I think it's kind of growing. But I would any student who asks, I would say do not take sport management for all of the reasons that you've probably experienced.
Sports sociology, though.
That is a great class.
There we go. Sign up today.
No, thank you.
Hi, my name is Lila. So you talk a lot in this book about the various forms of harm and suffering that these college athletes are experiencing, college workers. I would just love to hear a little bit about sort of how you approached an ethics of care in asking these players about such intimate and it sounds at times traumatizing experiences.
It's a great question and allows me to like shout out the campus athletic workers who shared these stories. Some of the stories in this book are horrifying, absolutely horrifying. And in the moment in the room, well, most were done in Zoom, through Zoom, there were tangible moments where we had to take a step back and ask even ourselves if what we're doing here is helping. Are we extracting? Are we doing too much? And thankfully, the participants of the book often were like, no, I want to share. This is the first time I'm able to share this. I have anonymity. I have confidentiality. I know this will never get out there. And I need to tell someone about what this coach did. In terms of a moment, like the worst parts for me were when folks were talking about mental health, both for themselves and also other campus athletic workers, some who ultimately would unalive themselves due to what they have told players was related to their time playing college football. And that was, some of those stories were horrifying. So in terms of how we actually dealt with that in the moment, we like took a step back and like paused and made sure this person wanted to share that story. And every single time they're like, this is the only time I'm going to be able to share this story. I go to some of them have said they've gone to media in the past and media isn't willing to listen. They're not willing to write it. Why? They don't want to give anonymity, or they want to out the players or the coaches because they want the story, right? So for these folks who we're still in contact with today, sharing that was like a sort of healing for them. At least that's what they've articulated to us. So it was challenging, very challenging, to say the least. No, thank you.
Yeah, that question goes unasked in newsrooms, in journalism. I mean, it is not an asked question.
Yeah.
It's how do you extract the most, frankly, the least work.
Yeah. Yeah. We, so. we, we had a story that we were pitching to a variety of news outlets that was an anonymous quote about a very, very, very famous college football coach, and they simply would not, and it was about harm and abuse as a result, a direct result of that coach. I obviously cannot share that, but every single major media outlet that we pushed it to said no because of the anonymity piece, because they wouldn't protect. They wanted all the details, even though we had receipts, multiple corroborating stories. They simply would not put it on record without the name. And that's vital. We learned through the process that that is why research is important. And that's why journalism can only go so far. Research in this area is vitally important, because that protection allows athletes to say what they actually feel.
No names, no clicks, though.
Exactly. Exactly.
Hi, my name is Mark, and I had an experience going to college where I was almost like an exchange student. I went to a small high school in New England where college football is the one part of the country where it really isn't much. There was Doug Flutie. It was the 80s, and that was it. Then I went to the University of Florida, and I felt like I didn't know. There was a language I didn't know. I went to a few games. I saw, you know, when Bo Jackson was there, when Auburn was in town, but I didn't know. But I knew some of the players, and I immediately said no. I knew their lives because they were my neighbors in my apartment. And I immediately said, no, they got to be, they're not going to school. I knew that. And then that was the era when Dexter Manley, it came out when Dexter Manley, was at Oklahoma that he went to, that he went through college and he was not literate. And, you know, so I wonder the people, the athletes that you worked with, that you teach, that you, how many of them would be able, I mean, not be able, but at what level, what is a university education? I mean, they absolutely should get the coupon or whatever, the scholarship, but what's best, do you think? I mean, and do you still see them coming through without, has that changed somewhat now than it did in the 80s?
Yeah. So the question of like whether or not campus athletic workers have like the abilities that other students have, certainly some will come in with experiences that don't align with the other, the sort of traditional student, and that causes issues. I would argue the bigger impediment on their learning is the fact that they have to do 60 hours of the most strenuous work while trying to participate in school. And I say trying because many people think like they sit at the back. Profs are the worst at this. Like my colleagues are the worst to say like, these are bad students. They're not prepared. They don't care. And I say like, no shit. They were playing football last night and then they were at practice this morning. Like how can they come to class? Of course they're going to be at the back sleeping. So like that's such an important impediment to learning and why they can't get the educational experience, far more than any question of whether or not they like sort of came in prepared. In my experiences and in the experiences that we document in the book, these were incredibly smart people. Some of the smartest people that I taught were on the college football and basketball teams.
We're running low on time. Let's get the next two speakers. We want to get everybody both speak, and maybe you could answer both questions.
Yeah, that's
after
great.
They both.
Hello, I'm Leonard, unabashed football fan. I'm sorry. When I was younger, we used to know what a catch was like, and you know now we make fun of nobody knows what a catch is. We also used to know what a year of eligibility meant, and now with NIL, we no longer know what a year of eligibility means. Recently, a player appealed for more eligibility because he went to junior college before the NCAA, and he was granted two more years. The quarterback for Vanderbilt exhausted his eligibility. He appealed for another year and was given another year because he didn't have adequate time to make money that other players have. With that being said, like with these college careers extending, do you think that will help them to collectivize and unionize? I don't know. Do you think that helps their cause, having the longer careers and have more of a chance to get settled in and establish themselves?
Great question. Yeah. Unintended consequences.
Hi, I'm Richard. I have a comment, then a quick question. I'm relating to your story about your son and how you couldn't keep him out of the sport. I have a nephew who's now in his 30s who had a different family circumstance. His parents said no, and that was the end of it. And even now, he's a big, tall, athletic guy. He said, I could have been a quarterback. You know, so different. So families, my question is the trend that more and more families are saying no and depleting the ranks of future college and professional? And if that's the case, is football disappearing in high school? Is the trend line going to solve this issue going forward? Is my question.
Great question. I'll start with time is but one structural factor that I think union busts or busts solidarity. The other features to that we outline in the book are like the amount of what we call borrowing on another sociologist, Aaron Hatton, status coercion, which is the amount of power that coaches have over the future earning potential. So those athletes are going to do what the coach says, no matter what. So if the coach says don't unionize, a lot of they have so much power over their future earning potential that they'll say yes. They'll say yes to not show concussion, et cetera, et cetera. So I think time is one thing. The ephemeral nature of like the 4 years, the traditional 4 year at being at university is one of the issues of why it's hard to unionize. So I think it will help. Like that will be an unintended kind of latent consequence of the new kind of rules around eligibility or like the lengthening of eligibility. But I don't think ultimately that will have like that will be the sort of tipping point.
So now the trend lines,
absolutely. We know that youth participation in football is decreasing across the board. We also know, and this was a brilliant piece published in Sociology of Sport Journal, I believe in 2023, that's very racialized. So white people are not putting their kids in football. So that's what's happening. It's a smaller and a very slight decrease in Hispanic and Black families. So we still see this kind of intergenerational tug on certain communities for participation in football. So ultimately, I actually think the racial disparity is going to get worse. I think that we're soon, football itself is going to be even more racialized, which is hard to think. It's very, very racialized as it is. So football may ultimately die for certain groups. That's what I'll say.
Any last thoughts? Then we'll get people getting some books.
Please buy a copy of the book.
The book is fantastic. I can't recommend it enough. Late holiday present, whatever. People should get it. Get it signed. Derek will personalize it. Do it for Nathan, who really wanted to be here. It really is a fantastic book. And I really want to thank you for writing it and introducing a debate that we really do need to have right now, not just in higher education, but throughout the sports world.
Thank you, and thanks everyone for coming.
Well, that's all the time we have this week. Thank you again to Politics and Prose for allowing us here at Edge of Sports to use the recording. Thank you so much to Derek Silva, Nathan Kalman Lamb. Everybody should read The End of College Football. For everybody out there listening, shout out Nation Magazine, of course, for sponsoring the pod. We are out of here. Peace.